Welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. For those of us who love them, the thrill you get from reading a great mystery is like riding a roller coaster. It's a rush. Titles filled with murder and mayhem serve up the perfect counterpoint to those mundane matters you need to get through each day. And isn't it a blast to suss out the bad guy before the hero knows who done it? My guest today is one of the masters of the genre. Steve Barry returns to the program to discuss his new Cotton Malone novel, The Patriot Threat. This book has a very timely and unexpected topic at its core, our national debt and income tax. Not the usual stuff of thrillers, but Steve always does his homework. And he laces his stories with little-known historical facts. So let's start our investigation as we turn to page one of the book report. The Book Report begins today's show with one incredibly dynamic duo. Joan Nesbo, one of my favorite thriller writers, is just out with Blood on Snow. And the incomparable Patti Smith performs the work. The book is a fast, darkly lyrical standalone novel that has the perfectly sympathetic anti-hero at its center, an Oslo contract killer who draws us into his unexpected meditation on death and love. Olaf is an extremely talented fixer for one of Oslo's most powerful crime bosses. But Olaf is also an unusually complicated fixer. He has a capacity for love that is as far-reaching as his gift for murder. He is our straightforward, calm-in-the-face-of-crisis narrator with a storyteller's hypnotic knack for fantasy. He has an innate talent for subordination, but running through his veins is a virus born of the power over life and death. And while his latest job puts him at the pinnacle of his trade, it may be mutating into his greatest mistake.
Hoffman asked me to go down to the office the next day. He said he had a new job for me. A new job? I asked, feeling my heart skip a beat. Yes, Hoffman said. As in a new commission. Oh, okay. I hung up relieved. I don't really do much more than commissions. I can't actually be used for much more than that. Here are four things I can't be used for. Driving a getaway car. I can drive fast, that's fine. But I can't drive inconspicuously, and anyone driving a getaway car has to be able to do both. They have to be able to drive so they look just like any other car on the road. I landed myself and two other men in prison because I can't drive inconspicuously enough. I drove like a demon, switching between forest tracks and main roads, and I had long since lost our pursuers and was just a few kilometers from the Swedish border. I slowed down and drove in a steady, law-abiding way like a granddad on a Sunday outing. And we still got stopped by a police patrol. They said afterwards that they had no idea it was the car used in the robbery and that I hadn't been driving too fast or breaking any of the rules of the road. They said it was the way I was driving. I have no idea what they meant, but they said it was suspicious. I can't be used in robberies. I've read that more than half of all bank employees who experience a robbery end up with psychological problems afterwards, some of them for the rest of their lives. I don't know why, but the old man who was behind the counter of the post office when we went in was in a big hurry to develop psychological problems. He fell to pieces just because the barrel of my shotgun was pointed in his general direction, apparently. I saw in the paper the next day that he was suffering from psychological problems. Not much of a diagnosis, but either way, if there's one thing you don't want, it's psychological problems. So I went to visit him in the hospital. Obviously, he didn't recognize me. I had been wearing a Santa Claus mask in the post office. It was the perfect disguise. No one gave a second glance to three lads in Santa Claus outfits carrying sacks as they ran out of a post office in the middle of the Christmas shopping crowds. I stopped in the doorway to the ward and looked at the old man. He was reading Class Struggle, the communist newspaper. Not that I've got anything against communists as individuals. Okay, maybe I have. But I don't want to have anything against them as individuals. I just think they're wrong. So I felt a bit guilty when I realized that I felt a lot better because the bloke was reading Class Struggle. But obviously, there's a big difference between feeling a bit guilty and a lot guilty. And like I said, I felt a lot better. But I stopped doing robberies. After all, there was no guarantee the next one would be a communist. And I can't work with drugs. That's number three. I just can't do it. It's not that I can't get money out of people who are in debt to my employers. Junkies only have themselves to blame, and in my opinion, people should pay for their mistakes, plain and simple. The problem's more that I have a weak, sensitive nature, as my mom once put it. I suppose she saw herself in me. Either way, I have to stay well away from drugs. Like her, I'm the sort of person who's just looking for someone to submit to. Religion, a big brother figure, a boss, drink and drugs. Besides, I can't do maths either. I can hardly count to 10 without losing my concentration, which is kind of stupid if you're going to sell drugs or collect debts. That ought to be pretty obvious. Okay, last one. Prostitution. Same sort of thing there. I don't have a problem with women earning money whatever way they like, and the idea that a bloke, me, for instance, should get a third of the money for sorting things out so the women can concentrate on the actual work. A good pimp is worth every crone they pay him. I've always thought that.
That was Blood on Snow by Joe Nesbo. Steve Barry has done it again, written an incredible thriller with history at its heart. History is Steve's passion. It's led him, along with wife Elizabeth, to create History Matters, a foundation dedicated to historic preservation. Since 2009, the couple has crossed the country to save endangered historic treasures. Steve was a trial lawyer for 30 years and held elective office for 14 of those years. And then he turned to writing, penning bestsellers that blend little-known historical fact with pulse-pounding fiction. His titles include The Lincoln Myth, The Columbus Affair, and The Templar Legacy. Steve is a founding member of the International Thriller Writers. His bestsellers have sold more than 19 million copies around the world. Today, we'll speak with him about his new title, Patriot Threat, one of my favorite reads this year. Welcome, Steve, and thanks for joining us on the Book Report.
Great to be here.
Steve, at the heart of Patriot Threat is something positively terrifying for any American to contemplate, our national debt and the 16th Amendment, the one that has to do with income tax. How in the world did you land upon this as the centerpiece of your new novel?
I stumbled across a theory one day. I was just doing some research on another subject matter, and I came across this concept about the 16th Amendment. There's been a lot of talk about the 16th Amendment for a long, long time, whether or not it may be valid or it may be problems with it. And as I read further, I began to see there's some very intriguing aspects to this whole question of the validity of the 16th Amendment. So I started developing it and wove it in, and it's made for a really good novel. It's a very clever weapon of mass destruction. It's a clever way of wreaking havoc, and it made for a great adventure for Cotton Malone.
And actually, the controversy around it is its ratification. Is that correct?
Yeah, the 16th Amendment was proposed by the Republicans back in 1913, and the whole idea was it was supposed to fail. It wasn't even supposed to pass, but it did. It made it, and it got certified as ratified. The question is, were there problems with that ratification process? There are some interesting issues with it, and all of those issues are explored in the novel. Some fascinating legal questions that the courts have been reluctant to take up.
The Patriot Threat has so much history to contemplate, but I'm wondering, since it also focuses on present-day Korea, how did you view the storm that surrounded the movie The Interview?
It was interesting. That book is a little more of a I guess the North Koreans might take that as a little more, a directness, a little more right up in their face kind of thing. This book deals with some actual true things regarding North Korea, and mainly the North Korean labor camps, which do exist. There are 200,000 people interred in those camps, and they've had a horrific time for many, many decades. And I wanted to draw some attention to those death camps, so they figure into the novel.
How did you do the research for that?
There is one book, and because there's one man who was in the camps, escaped, and wrote a book about it. It's called Escape from Camp 14. It's a firsthand account of what happened, and so I was able to take a look at that account and to incorporate the spirit of it and some of that into the novel. It's referenced in the back, so readers will be able to check it out if they want to. And as I said, it's some pretty horrible things that happened in those camps.
You write that in Korea, to paraphrase, the seed of the enemies of the state must be eliminated through three generations. Is that based on fact?
Yes, they actually do that. You're interred into the camp, and it's for three generations that before they, as they eliminate the seeds of dissent within you, supposedly. They are horrible, horrible places. The book Escape from Camp 14 is not for the faint of heart.
One of the main characters in the book, Kim Jong-jin, a son of the Korean dictator, was disinherited because he tried to sneak his family into Japan's Disneyland. Did this actually happen?
It actually did happen. That character is based on the real-life older brother of the current ruler of North Korea, who actually did that a few years ago. And he was disinherited by his father. And that's actually how we got the current ruler of North Korea, because he was not really in line to succeed. He succeeded because of what happened with the older brother. The older brother was a very interesting kind of character. I incorporated some of his real-life experiences into the book.
Okay, please shed some light on Andrew Mellon and his relationship with FDR.
They hated each other. They hate each other horribly, and FDR actually had Mellon indicted for tax evasion, and Mellon beat it. The courts ruled in his favor, so he and FDR did not get along at all. FDR blamed him for everything that went on with the Depression. Mellon blamed FDR for everything wrong with the New Deal. They were just two completely polar opposites. But the meeting that occurred on December 31st, 1936, that's in the prologue of the novel, actually happened. And the National Gallery of Art was born in that meeting. I just added another little twist to it to make for the novel.
I never knew, as many times as I visited the National Gallery, that it was, in fact, Andrew Mellon who was responsible for that.
He is the man. He put money down. It was built to his specifications. He had a lot to do with creating everything about it. Even though he died 4 years before it was opened, what he left in place was honored and kept on by the folks that eventually completed the building and created it. So, yes, Andrew Mellon is 100% responsible for the National Gallery of Art.
I was fascinated to read about Chaim Soloman and his contributions to the beginnings of our country. Can you share some of that with our listeners?
He is one of the great unsung heroes of the American Revolution. He's the guy that went out and got the money to pay for the revolution. I mean, a war has to be financed, and America at that time was broke, and Soloman figured out a way to get the money. He actually loaned the country $800,000 of his own money, without which the revolution would have gone away. It would never have succeeded. George Washington himself acknowledged that contribution, and some say that he left a little present or a little symbol of that contribution on the Great Seal of America, which now appears on the $1 bill. That's explored in the novel, too. That $800,000 debt has never been repaid by this country. By some estimates today, it could be worth as much as $300 billion.
And have his descendants ever pursued repayment of the debt?
They did. They pursued it for a long, long time. They gave up really at the early part of the 20th century. Congress considered it five times on the repayment, but never acted on it. And there's been nothing ever mentioned on, for the last 100 plus years, nothing has happened on it. I stumbled across him in my research. I realized that was a fascinating character, so that's just the perfect kind of guy that I like to have in my novels, so he earned a place.
Yeah, I was fascinated by him. Are you already at work on a new novel?
The next year's book is finished and turned in. In the book business, you stay a year ahead. So I've turned in next year's book. It'll be another Cotton Malone adventure, a fascinating story that deals with the Cold War. It's called The 14th Colony.
All right. And do you ever contemplate writing books not starring Cotton Malone?
Well, I've done four. I've done Amber Room, Romanoff Prophecy, Third Secret, and Columbus Affair have been standalones, but probably not for the foreseeable future. Cotton will be around for a little bit. Readers seem to really like him, but I wouldn't say that would never happen again, no. I'm sure it will.
All right. Well, I want you to know that I thought this was one of my favorite reads of this year. It is such a page-turner. Steve, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great to be here, and I hope everybody go out and check it out in stores.
All right. Thank you, Steve. And now, let's hear a sample of The Patriot Threat, performed by Scott Brick.
No feeling in the world is greater, more ennobling, and more sacred than patriotism. Kim Il-sung, Eternal President, Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Prologue. White House, Thursday, December 31st, 1936, 5 p.m. Franklin Roosevelt hated being in the same room with his infamous visitor, but he appreciated the need for them to talk. He'd been president 4 years, but 3 weeks from now, history will mark his second inauguration, the first held on January 20th. Before that, the oath had always been taken on March 4th, commemorative of the exact day in 1789 when the Constitution first took effect. But the 20th Amendment changed that. A good idea, actually, shortening the time after the November election day. Too much of a lame duck made for a dead duck. He liked being a part of change, hated the way anything was once done, and he particularly despised any member of the old order, like his visitor. Andrew Mellon had served 10 years and 11 months as Secretary of Treasury. He started with Harding in 1921, then worked for Coolidge before being eased from office by Hoover. He completed his government service with 1 year as ambassador to the court of St. James, finally retiring in 1933. Mellon was a staunch Republican, then and now one of the wealthiest men in the country, the living embodiment of old order wisdom the New Deal longed to change. Here, Mr. President, is my offer. I hope it can be carried out. Mellon handed over a piece of paper. He'd invited this pariah to afternoon tea because his advisors had cautioned him that you can kick a mean dog only so long. And he'd been kicking Andrew Mellon for 3 years. It started just after his first inauguration. He'd instructed the Bureau of Internal Revenue to audit Mellon's 1931 tax returns. There'd been departmental resistance to his over-exercise of presidential power, words to the effect that Internal Revenue should not be used as a political weapon, but his directive had been carried out. Mellon had claimed a $139,000 refund. The government found that he owed $3,089,000. Charges of tax evasion were brought, but a grand jury declined to indict. Undaunted, Roosevelt ordered the Justice Department to proceed civilly, and a trial was held in the Board of Tax Appeals, involving 14 months of testimony and evidence. It had ended only a few weeks ago. They occupied the Oval Study on the second floor, his favorite spot in the White House to conduct business. It had an overcrowded, lived-in look from packed bookcases, ship models, and a confusion of paper piled everywhere. A fire raged in the hearth. He'd abandoned his wheelchair and sat on the sofa, Attorney General Homer Cummings beside him. Accompanying Mellon was David Finley, a close associate of the former secretary. He and Cummings read Mellon's offering. It laid out a proposal for the establishment of an art museum to be located on the National Mall, which Mellon would erect at his own expense. The building not only would become a repository for Mellon's own massive collection, it would also accommodate future acquisitions. To be called the National Gallery of Art. "Not the Andrew W. Mellon Gallery?" he asked. "I do not want my name publicly associated with the building."
That was The Patriot Threat by Steve Barry. The Whites is a debut of a writer sure to become a master of American crime fiction, Harry Brandt, the pen name of novelist Richard Price. The Whites takes place in the run-and-gun days of the mid-1990s. When Billy Graves worked in the South Bronx as part of an anti-crime unit known as the Wild Geese, he made headlines by accidentally shooting a 10-year-old boy during a drug bust. Branded as a cowboy by his higher-ups, for the next 18 years, Billy endured one dead-end posting after another. Now, in his early 40s, he's somehow survived and become a sergeant on the Manhattan Night Watch, a small team of detectives charged with responding to nighttime felonies from Wall Street to Harlem. Night Watch usually acts as a setup crew for the day shift, but when Billy is called to a 4 a.m. fatal slashing of a man in Penn Station, his investigation moves beyond the usual handoff. And when he discovers the victim was once a suspect in an unsolved murder of a 12-year-old boy, a case with connections to the former members of the Wild Geese, the bad old days are back. Richard Price, one of America's most gifted novelists, always writes brilliantly about cops, criminals, and New York City. Now writing as Harry Brandt, he's poised to win a huge following among all those who hunger for first-rate crime fiction. Ari Filakos narrates.
June, the night clerk with his gaffer-taped horn rims, automatically began gathering up his regular customer's nightly ration. 3 16-ounce Rockstar energy drinks, 2 Shaolin Power Gel squibs, and a pack of Camel Lights. Billy cracked a can of Go before it could be bagged.
"Too much of that shit make you even more tired," the Korean delivering his standard lecture. "Like a boomerang."
No doubt. As he reached for his Visa card, the security monitor next to the register caught Billy in all his glory. Football burly but slumped-shouldered, his pale face with its exhaustion-starred eyes topped with half a pitchfork's worth of prematurely graying hair. He was only 42, but that crushed cellophane gaze of his combined with a world-class insomniac's posture had once gotten him into a movie at a senior citizen's discount. Man was not meant to start work after midnight. End of story. Pay differential be damned. The Night Watch office, on the second floor of the 15th Precinct and time-shared with Manhattan's South Homicide, which occupied it during the day, looked like a cross between a funhouse and a morgue. It was a dreary, fluorescently lit scrum of gunmetal-grade desks, separated by plastic partitions brightened with autographed 8x10s of Derek Jeter, Samuel L. Jackson, Rex Ryan, and Harvey Keitel, along with mugshots, family snaps, and garish crime scene photos. An 8-foot glass tank filled with miniature shark-like catfish dominated one cinder block wall, an embassy-sized American flag fronting the other. None of his regular squad were in. Emmett Butter, a part-time actor so fresh to the unit that Billy had yet to allow him to spearhead a run. Gene Feely, who back in the late 80s was part of the team that broke up the Fat Cat Nichols crack empire, had 32 years on the job, owned 2 bars in Queens, and was just there to max out his pension. Alice Stupak, who worked nights in order to be with her family during the day, and Roger Mayo, who worked nights in order to avoid being with his family during the day. It wasn't unusual for the room to be deserted 30 minutes into the tour, given that Billy didn't care where his detectives spent the shift as long as they answered their phones when he needed them.
He didn't see the point of making everyone sit at their desks all night like they were in detention. But in exchange for this freedom, if any one of them, with the exception of Feely, who was so old boy wired into one PP that he could do or not do anything he wanted, if any one of them failed to pick up when he called, even once, they were gone from the squad, dead batteries, toilet drops, drop kicks, theft, Armageddon, the rapture, or no. Depositing the grocery bag in his minute windowless office, Billy walked out of the squad room and down a short hall to the dispatcher's desk, manned by Raleigh Towers, a.k.a. The Wheel. A big Buddha boy in track pants and a John Jay College sweatshirt, ballooning off either side of his webbed Aeron chair as he fielded the incoming calls, taking all requests for night watch from the various crime sites and fending them off like a goalie.
"Well, look, Sarge, my boss isn't in yet," Raleigh nodding to Billy. "But my guess is here's what he's gonna say. Nobody got hurt. Guy can't even say for sure it was a gun. I'd just throw a good interview at him, wait for the 5th squad to come in tomorrow morning, see if it fits any kind of pattern they're working, all right? There's really not that much for us to do on this one. No problem. No problem. No problem."
Hanging up and swiveling to Billy.
"No problem."
"Anything happening?" Billy reached for one of Raleigh's Doritos, then changed his mind.
"Throw down in the 3-2. Both shooters female, one on the sidewalk, the other in the rear seat of a ghetto cab. They're like maybe a couple of yards apart, 6 shots fired back and forth, and get this, neither of them gets hit. How's that for sharpshooting?"
"Was the cab moving?"
"It started out. One of the broads was chasing the other through the Eisenhowers. She jumps in the car, screams for the driver to haul ass, but the minute he sees the guns, he jumps out and starts hoofing it back to Senegal, probably halfway there as we speak."
"Feeds do your stuff."
"Butter and Mayo are up on the 3-2 watching Annie Oakley and Calamity Jane sleep it off."
"And the driver, for real?"
"They found him 8 blocks away trying to climb a tree. They took him in for an interview, but he only speaks Wolof and French, so they're waiting on a translator."
"Anything else?"
"No, sir."
"And who do I got?"
That was a sampling of The Whites by Harry Brandt. A deep cover CIA agent races across Europe to save the daughter he never knew in The Swimmer by Joachim Sander. Clara Waldeen was raised by her grandparents on a remote archipelago in the Baltic Sea, learning to fish and hunt and sail a boat through a storm. Now, as an EU Parliament aide in Brussels, she's learning how to navigate the treacherous currents of international politics. But Clara has accidentally seen something she shouldn't have. A laptop containing information so sensitive, someone will kill to keep it hidden. Suddenly, she's thrown into a terrifying chase across Europe with no idea of who is hunting her or why. Meanwhile, in Virginia, an old spy hides from the past. Once he was a man of action, an operative so dedicated he abandoned his infant daughter to keep his cover. Now he's the only man who could save Clara, and she's the only woman who can allow him to lay old ghosts to rest. Peter Gannon and Elizabeth Rogers share the narration.
"The heat even muffles sound, I think. Delays it, slows it down. We both bend down to pick up the keys. For a moment, our fingers brush against one another. Our eyes. Then you snatch the keys, stand up, and disappear into the echoing stairwell. You leave behind only the muffled sound of a slamming door. I stand with the baby in the sliver of shade on the balcony facing the street. The memory of a breeze floats across my face. The heat makes it difficult to breathe. In the air, exhaust, cumin. What happened to the jasmine? Once this city smelled like jasmine. The locket you gave me before everything turned to heat, fever, and flight burns against my chest. The one that once belonged to your grandmother, your mother. I'm thinking about leaving it here. I'm thinking of leaving it on the sideboard in the hallway, the one with inlays of mother of pearl and rosewood that we bought together in the bazaar when this bond had been growing for less than a week. I don't feel like I have the right to take the locket with me. It doesn't belong to me anymore, if it ever did. I know everything there is to know about surviving. I know every street in this city, every cafe. I know every mustachioed antique store owner with shady business contacts, every gossipy carpet dealer, the boy who sells tea out of the huge samovar he carries on his back. I've sipped imported whiskey with the president in smoky rooms, together with the leaders of organizations he officially repudiates. The president knows my name, one of my names. I've been handling the money, making sure it ends up in hands that benefit the interests I've been sent here to protect. If you meet me, I speak your language better than you do. At the same time, move me somewhere else. Drop me in the jungle, on the steps, in the lobby of the Savoy Hotel. Give me a minute. I'll become a lizard, a yellowed blade of grass, a pinstriped young banker with hair that's a little too long and a motley but privileged past. I know your friends from university, vaguely, through others. They never remember me. You don't know it, but I am so much better than you. I change faster, fit in better. I have hazier outlines and a harder core. I keep my bonds loose. If they tighten, I cut them. And now, I lost my concentration and let them grow beyond my control, let them harden, coagulate, blood bonds. The game is forever, but this round is over. I hold the child tighter against my chest and shuffle impatiently on the concrete. When images of death sweep through me, I squeeze my eyes shut and shake my head. Whisper to myself, "No, no, no." The swollen face in the open sewer out by the highway to the airport. Those staring eyes. The flies in the heat. The flies. No, no, no. Why didn't I just let him be? I already knew everything. Why did I persuade Firas to have another meeting when the trail was already red-hot, glowing? But it was too inconsistent, too hard to believe. I had to hear it again. Look into Firas's nervous eyes one more time to see if something was hiding there. See if a shadow passed over his face when he reluctantly repeated the details one last time. See if his nervous tics had escalated or disappeared completely. All of those signs, all those little nuances, all those things that make up the almost imperceptible line between truth and lies, life and death.
We've just heard The Swimmer by Joachim Sander. Dennis Lehane, author of books I always recommend to friends, returns with a psychologically and morally complex novel of blood, crime, passion, and vengeance. World Gone By is set in World War II in Cuba and Ybor City, Florida. 10 years have passed since Joe Coughlin's enemies killed his wife and destroyed his empire, and much has changed. Prohibition is dead, the world is at war again, and Joe's son, Tomas, is growing up. Now the former crime kingpin works as a consigliere to the Bartolo crime family, traveling between Tampa and Cuba, his wife's homeland. A master who moves in and out of the black, white, and Cuban underworlds, Joe effortlessly mixes with Tampa's social elite, U.S. Naval Intelligence, the Lansky-Luciano mob, and the mob-financed Batista government. He has everything: money, power, a beautiful mistress, and anonymity. But success cannot protect him from the dark truth of his past. And ultimately, the wages of a lifetime of sin will be paid in full. Jim Frangione performs the book.
The participants that night back in December had all been engaged, as far as they understood it, in a wholly innocent union of people who supported the soldiers overseas. Joseph Coughlin, the businessman, had organized the event because so many of his former employees had enlisted or been drafted. Vincent Imbruglia, who had two brothers in the fight, one in the Pacific, one somewhere in Europe, no one would confirm where, ran the raffle. The grand prize was two front-row tickets to a Sinatra concert at the Paramount in New York at the end of the month, and first-class carriage on the Tamiami Champion. Everyone bought rafts of tickets, even though most assumed the wheel was rigged so the mayor's wife, a huge Sinatra fan, would win. The boss of bosses, Dion Bartolo, showed off the kind of dance moves that had won him prizes in his adolescence. In the process, he gave the mothers and daughters of some of Tampa's most respectable families stories to tell their grandchildren. No man who dances with such grace can be as bad as some have claimed. Rico DiGiacomo, the brightest star in the Tampa underworld, showed up with his brother, Freddie, and their beloved mother, his dangerous glamour only outdone by the arrival of Montooth Dix, an exceptionally tall Negro made taller by the top hat that matched his tuxedo. Most members of the Tampa elite had never seen a Negro pass through a party without a serving tray on his palm, but Montooth Dix moved through the crowd of white people like he expected them to serve him. The party was just respectable enough to be attended without regret and just dangerous enough to be worth remarking on for the rest of the season. Joe Coughlin had a gift for bringing the beacons of the city into contact with her demons and making it all seem like a lark. It helped that Coughlin himself, once rumored to have been a gangster and quite a powerful one, had clearly evolved past the street. He was one of the biggest charity supporters in all of West Central Florida, a friend to numerous hospitals, soup kitchens, libraries, and shelters. And if the other rumors were true, that he hadn't fully left his criminal past behind, well, one couldn't fault a man for a bit of loyalty to those he'd known on the way up. Certainly, if some of the assembled tycoons, factory owners, and builders wished to settle any labor unrest or unclog their supply routes, they knew who to call. Joe Coughlin was the bridge in this town between what was proclaimed in public and how it was achieved in private. When he threw a party, you came just to see who'd show up. Joe himself conferred upon the festivities no further significance than that. When a man threw a party where the upper crust mingled with street thugs and judges chatted with capos as if they'd never met before, either in court or in a back room, when the Sacred Heart pastor showed up and blessed the room before imbibing with the same gusto as everyone else, when Vanessa Belgrave, the pretty but icy wife of the mayor, raised a glass of thanks in Joe's direction, and a Negro as fearsome as Montooth Dix could regale a group of stuffy old white men with tales of his exploits in the Great War, and not a cross word or drunken faux pas was witnessed by anyone. Well, that party was not only a success, it was quite possibly the success of the season. The only sign of trouble occurred after Joe stepped out on the back lawn to get some air and saw the little boy. He moved in and out of the darkness at the far edge of the back lawn. He zigzagged back and forth, as if he were playing tag with other boys. But there were no other boys. Judging by his height and build, he was about 6 or 7 years old. He spread his arms wide and made the sound of a propeller and then of a plane engine. He made wings of his arms and careened along the fringe of the tree line, shouting, "Vroom! Vroom!" Joe couldn't put his finger on what else was odd about the kid, other than being a child alone at an adult party, until he realized his clothes were a good 10 years out of date. More like 20, actually. The kid wearing knickerbockers, Joe was pretty sure, and one of those oversized golf caps boys wore back when Joe himself had been a boy. The kid was too far away for Joe to get a good look at his face, but he had the odd sensation that even if he were closer, it wouldn't have made a difference. Even from this far away, he could tell the boy's face was irrevocably indistinct.
We've just heard World Gone By by Dennis Lehane. The stranger appears out of nowhere, perhaps in a bar or a parking lot or at the grocery store. His identity is unknown. His motives are unclear. His information is undeniable. Then he whispers a few words in your ear and disappears, leaving you picking up the pieces of your shattered world. In The Stranger by Harlan Coben, Adam Price has a lot to lose. A comfortable marriage to a beautiful woman, two wonderful sons, and all the trappings of the American dream. A big house, a great job, a seemingly perfect life. Then he runs into The Stranger. When he learns a devastating secret about his wife, he confronts her, and the mirage of perfection disappears as if it had never existed at all. Soon, Adam finds himself tangled in something darker than his wife's deception and realizes that if he doesn't make exactly the right moves, the conspiracy he stumbled into will not only ruin lives, it will end them. George Newbern narrates.
When he was back home and in his office nook, Adam hit the link in the email and watched the website come up. Fakeapregnancy.com. Adam tried not to react. He knew that the internet catered to every peccadillo and taste, even ones that defy the imagination. But the fact that there was an entire website based on faking a pregnancy was yet another one of the moments when a rational human being just wants to surrender and cry and admit that our worst instincts have won. Underneath the large pink lettering, in a slightly smaller font, was the tagline, "Funniest gags ever." Gags? He clicked on the link for the featured products you purchased. The top item was for a super new fake pregnancy test. Adam just shook his head. The normal price of $34.95 had a red slash through it in favor of the sale price, $19.99. And then in black italics underneath that, you save $15. Well, great. Thanks for the savings. I sure hope my wife didn't pay retail. The item shipped in 24 hours with discreet packaging. He read farther down the page. Use it the same way you would a real pregnancy test. Urinate on the strip and read the results. They show up positive every time. Adam's mouth felt dry. Scare the bejesus out of your boyfriend or your in-laws or your cousin or your professor. Cousin and professor? Who the hell wants to scare a cousin or professor into thinking? Adam didn't even want to go there. There was a warning in small print on the bottom. Caution, this item has the potential to be used irresponsibly. By completing and submitting the form below, you agree not to use this product for purposes that may be illegal, immoral, fraudulent, or hurtful to others. Incredible. He clicked the item image and zoomed in on the packaging. The test was a white strip with a red cross indicating pregnancy. Adam racked his brain. Was that the test Corinne had used? He didn't remember. Had he even bothered looking? He couldn't be sure. They all looked the same anyway, didn't they? But he did recall now that Corinne had done the test while he was home. That was new for her. With Thomas and Ryan, Corinne had greeted him at the door with a big smile and told him the news. But this last time, she had wanted him there. He remembered that. He had been lying in bed, flipping stations on the television. She had gone into the bathroom. He thought the test might take a few minutes, but that wasn't the case. She had come running out of the bathroom with the strip. "Adam, look, I'm pregnant." Had the strip looked like this? He didn't know. Adam clicked the second link and just dropped his head into his hands. Fake silicone bellies. These came in various sizes. First trimester, 1 to 12 weeks. Second trimester, 13 to 27 weeks. Third trimester, 28 to 40 weeks. There was also an extra large size and one for twins, triplets, and even quadruplets. There was a photograph of a beautiful woman gazing lovingly at her pregnant belly. She wore a wedding gown white and held lilies in her hand. The sales pitch on the top read, "Nothing throws you in the spotlight like being pregnant." And underneath that, a less subtle pitch, "Get better presents." The product was made of medical-grade silicone that the site described as the closest thing to skin invented so far. On the bottom, there were video testimonials from real fake-a-pregnancy clients. Adam clicked on one. A pretty brunette smiled into the camera and said, Hi, I love my silicone belly. It's so natural. She went on to explain that it had arrived in just 2 business days. Not quite as fast as the pregnancy test, but you wouldn't need it as fast, would you? And that she and her husband were adopting and didn't want their friends to know. The second woman, this time a thin redhead, explained that she and her husband were using a surrogate and didn't want their friends to know. Adam hoped, then, for their sakes, that their friends were not creepy enough to frequent this website and out them.
That was The Stranger by Harlan Coben. Cuba Straits is the new thriller in the popular Doc Ford series by Randy Wayne White. This time out, Doc Ford's old friend, General Juan Garcia, has gone into the lucrative business of smuggling Cuban baseball players into the U.S. He's also feasting on profits made by buying historical treasures for pennies on the dollar. But when he manages to obtain a collection of letters written by Fidel Castro between 1960 and 62 to a secret girlfriend, it's no longer a matter of money. Garcia has stumbled way out of his depth. First, Garcia disappears. Then the man who bought the letters goes missing. When Doc Ford begins to investigate, he becomes convinced the letters contain a secret that someone or some powerful agency cannot allow to be made public. So much happened between Cuba and the U.S. from 1960 to 62. Many men died. A few more will hardly be noticed. The book is performed by the wonderful George Guidall.
Ford handed her his glasses, jogged to the breakers, and duck-dived, still wearing his damn boots. The dog, which was a retriever but not a lab or golden, swam after him. That was a mistake, too. The turtle, barnacles on its back, was tangled in fishing line and, yes, drowning. Ford had to alternately battle his dog, then the turtle, which hissed and struck like a snake while he maneuvered the thing through waves into the shallows. The woman was impressed.
"You seem to know what you're doing."
"On rare occasions. Do you have a knife?"
"You're not going to..."
"Of course not." The woman galloped to the cottage, her sweatshirt bouncing in countersink, legs not long but solid. "Nice." She watched Ford cut the turtle free, inspect it for cuts, then nurse the animal back through the surf where he side-stroked alongside for a while. The woman was waiting with a towel, coffee in a mug, and water for the dog.
"Why not come inside and dry off? Or a hot shower, if you like. But you'll have to forgive the mess."
The look the woman gave him was unmistakable. Not that Ford often got that look from women he didn't know. "3 mornings straight I've watched you run past here," an awkward smile, "so I finally worked up the nerve. Is it always this windy in November?" Ford cleaned his glasses with a towel.
"Nerve? Old-fashioned, I guess. You know, speaking to strange men and all that."
Another look, eyes aware, before she added, "I'm here all alone." Ford tested several excuses before he followed the woman inside. He was thinking, why do the lonely ones choose islands? That night in Fort Myers, off Daniels Road, he was at Hammond Stadium with the Minnesota Twins train, one of the practice fields, listening to his friend Tomlinson ramble on about something, but not really listening.
"Which is why," his friend concluded, "I don't even watch a game on TV without wearing the old codpiece."
Mentioning fish got Ford's attention. "You caught a cod? They don't migrate this far south."
"No, man, my cup. Until a woman finds an expiration date on my... I simply will not risk the hat-trick twins."
Tomlinson wrapped 3 bell tones from between his legs to illustrate, which proved nothing, because they were sitting in a dugout under lights, wearing baseball uniforms, not in a bar, watching TV. On the field was a senior league team from Orlando. A left-hander warming up while the umpires kibitzed, game time stalled for no apparent reason. Tomlinson muttered,
"Jesus, what's the holdup?"
He grabbed the fence, yelled, "Hey, Blue, while we're still young, okay?" before returning to Ford.
"You seem distracted, old buddy. Romantic problems, or is it something unusual?"
Ford replied, "This morning I found a turtle tangled in fishing line. One of those crimped wire leaders tourists buy at Walgreens. I assumed it was a loggerhead because they're so common. Now I don't think so.
Was it dead?
Goddamn pharmaceutical companies. They'd sell Pop-Tarts to diabetics if it bumped their numbers. The turtle was only about 50 pounds, but already had barnacles growing. See what I'm getting at? Even a young loggerhead or hawksbill would be closer to 100. Or maybe I'm wrong about that, too. I had him in my hands, but didn't bother to notice details. Embarrassing how little I know about sea turtles. Wouldn't you expect a biologist to notice what the hell species it was? Tomlinson knew the pitcher from Orlando, or would not have yelled,
Joe, hey, Joey, put some color in that rainbow. Slow pitch is for commies, dude.
This ultra-left-wing Zen Buddhist priest, he'd been ordained in Japan, and dope-smoking boat bum, was a different person when he exited reality and entered a baseball field. Joey flipped Tomlinson the bird. Ford mused. Now I'm thinking it might have been a Kemp's Ridley turtle or even a Pacific Ridley. Two of the rarest in the world. The thing snapped at me like a dog, which is typical according to the literature. And its shell was too round. Had it right there in my hands, swam with it, and still didn't dawn on me. If that's not a metaphor for something, I don't know what the hell is.
That was a sampling of Cuba Straits by Randy Wayne White. Readers, you have to love thrillers. A good writer has that amazing ability to keep you on the hook, so involved, determined to see it through. And of course, the highest compliment you can pay an author? I just couldn't put it down. For more best-selling titles across the wide world of genres, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me on today's wild ride. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.